You are listening to Beautiful Minds, the podcast. Beautiful Minds captures honest and optimistic conversations with smart, passionate, and genuine people who seek to change the world for the better. For now, we're starting small with a series of portraits of individuals who, in 2011, got together to study human rights in Europe. They came from different places, different backgrounds, and had very different stories. All they had in common was their appetite for social justice and a motivation to make a difference. Almost a decade later, let's see where they are, what they've done, and what they've learned. At Beautiful Minds, we start small and we dream big. Thank you for tuning in, and let's get started. Welcome into this podcast. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me. I think the last time we saw each other was in Kathmandu. Do you remember?
It was after you completed your trekking around Annapurna Base Camp.
Exactly, with Luna and Yuba. It was such an amazing experience. I loved it. I cannot wait to be back into Nepal and into the Himalayas. It was super fun. So I'm assuming you are also on lockdown in Nepal. I mean, I've read a little bit about it. How is the situation on your side? How are you? Where are you? Tell me a bit about yourself.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for trusting me to have conversation with you in the initial session. So I'm currently based in Kathmandu, my hometown. I'm in Nepal and we are under lockdown currently. It's been a while and we still have had any casualties because of COVID yet. We have around 30 plus cases in Nepal, but as precaution, government have locked down. And it's atmosphere of anxiety for everyone. It's a bit of pressure. But considering like what's going on in other parts of the world, like so far we're holding on tight, I guess.
All right. So I think we can start maybe where, you know, it all started. So we can start with this master's that we did together. So we were together in Europe, you know, from 2011 to 2013. We traveled into three different countries. And I kind of wanted to go back to that time a little bit, you know, and ask you, what was your experience of being in Europe? You know, what were the things that kind of struck you, you know, in Europe that you felt were kind of interesting or different or disturbing, you know? I don't know if you have any thoughts, you know, and when it comes to the masters, you know, per se, I don't know if you have like a best memory from that time that you carry with you.
So particularly for me, the master's program was very interesting in terms of learning curve outside classroom. So it was like being together with the diverse group of people from 17 different countries, different cultural background, different context, different, like it was quite a group. So for me, it was amazing experience, like blending in, trying to be part of the group and moving together was one aspect of it. The other part was what I actually saw in Europe, particularly during the field visit. So one thing that strikes me as a very important part was the trip we had in Norway, if you remember, when we went to Finnmark and where we saw Sami Parliament and other things. That was fun part when I was there, but when I came back to Nepal and started working and particularly started teaching as well. And then whenever I was talking about like minority and indigenous group, that trip has made me like, so I can picturize like what would work and other things. So there are a lot of things, like particularly during the classes, the nature of the group we had, the mobility and the learning from the group itself was very important aspect of the program. So considering like if it was quite fun, like fun wise, the entire program was quite fun for me. It was like, so living with Matthew and then like being part of the class, so it was interesting. Like it was quite a fun. And in terms of learning as well, I think it's very invaluable because of the nature of the group and the nature of mobility we had. So I think it's like having connection. For example, like I'm connected to you, and then like the connections now we have is also like one thing that's very interesting, and I think it has wider impact now and in the years to come. That's interesting. I think there are a lot of different things that I find interesting. So,
absolutely, no, absolutely. So tell me, what did you do right after the end of the program? You know, we graduated in June 2013. We were all together in London. You know, we had this ceremony. I remember it was even sunny, you know, which is quite exceptional for London. And then, you know, did you return to Nepal right away? How did you feel, you know, coming back to Nepal? And then how did you transition, you know, from that kind of student life of the past 2 years back into working? You know, I don't know, is it easy or was it easy at the time for young graduates to get a job in the nonprofit sector in Nepal? Was it a struggle for you? Was it very smooth? I mean, tell me a bit about that time.
So yeah, after like defending a thesis in London, I came back immediately to Nepal. So it was like July 2013, I came back. Because I was from legal background before, we have a very strong but not so big legal fraternity in Nepal. So I was in touch with friends at home. A lot of people knew I was doing my master's program. So when I came back home, it took me a while. I think like I started my teaching career in September after I came back, September 2013. And I'm continuing that as a part-time work for me where I teach undergraduate and graduate student human rights law coursework. So that was that. And in between, like, I only joined a full-time job next year in 2014 in April when I started as human rights lawyer in one of the leading nonprofit organizations in Nepal, and help them with the project relating to migrant workers. So for me, I think it's been like very smooth, particularly after coming back, because having a joint master's that we had, it was considered as an ASAT. So in academia and as well as in profession, I had a very smooth transition. I wouldn't say I had to struggle a bit or had to like spend quite a time looking for a job. I actually got offers when I came back, but I wanted to breathe in between, so I didn't join the job immediately. But it was a very smooth transition, and I think it was quite swift for me.
That's amazing. That's good. I'm glad to hear that. And so can you tell us a little bit more about what you're working on right now? So this morning, as I was preparing for this interview, I was reading the Kathmandu Post, you know, the English-speaking newspaper of Nepal. And I was looking at the most read articles. So it's a big newspaper. I mean, of course, it's English speaking, so it's for a targeted audience. But, you know, it's a big newspaper. So I read, you know, one of the articles about migrant workers, Nepali migrant workers in Qatar. And of course, there was your name on it. You were quoted into the article, right? And so, I mean, congrats on that. I think it's amazing, you know, that you're quoted in national newspapers. And so can you tell me a little bit more about what it is that you're working on? You know, what are the kind of hot topics, you know, at the moment in Nepal when it comes to human rights, you know, and to the human rights sector?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. So I've been continuously working in the same area after graduation, which is frankly very interesting. From 2014, I've been working in issues relating to rights of migrant workers in Nepal. So to give it a little bit of context, like more than 4 million Nepali work as migrant workers in different countries. So it's quite a significant chunk of productive group of young people who work in different countries, particularly in Gulf and in Malaysia. So there are like a lot of migrant workers from Nepal working in different parts of the world, with a huge concentration in GCC and Malaysia. So my work started as in rights of migrant workers. So our work was to identify issue regarding the rights of migrant workers and see what we can change in home. So it's form of a strategic litigation aimed at policy reform in home country, because like we're not in a position where we can change things in destination country, particularly, you know, like how things are in Middle East and how difficult it's, particularly in terms of human rights, how different it is from other countries. So we started looking into things that we can reform at home from policy level. And as a lawyer, we thought like strategic litigation, like taking up cases in the courts in Nepal and inducing policy reform through judicial order would be relevant. So we thought like strategic litigation is one of the key area that we can use to reform policies regarding to rights of migrant workers. So initially, for 2 years, we were more busy on litigation and research, but frankly, it didn't work out initially because it was a very huge issue, and the ideas regarding migrant workers' rights, such as supply chain, due diligence obligation, wasn't much talked about issue in Nepal. Though migrant population work, well, the migrant population was significant. The right of migrant workers were not at pinnacle in the moment. Like I'm talking about 14, 15. But all of a sudden, there's this surge of plight of migrant workers issue, and it was covered in international media. So it grew as one of the most alarming human rights concerns for Nepal, beside the issue regarding the transitional justice that we have, which has been here. So yeah, from 2014, I've been working in migrant workers issue. I'm involved in research. I do litigation in Supreme Court of Nepal in relevant issues that is aimed at directly aimed at policy reform. And for the last 5-6 years, it's been quite a learning as well as sort of a advocacy work for me. And now I'm involved with organization called Law and Policy Forum for Social Justice. We call it LAPSOS in short. And it's one of the leading organizations now which works in migrant workers issue. And fortunately, we have good friends, and our work is covered widely in national as well as international news. So it's kind of interesting work, but it's very strictly policy reform through strategic litigation. So yeah, that's what I've been involved, and I'm currently also I'm working on the particular aspect, because in context of this pandemic, like COVID, there's huge concern regarding what's going to happen to migrant workers who are in destination countries. So they're roughly government estimates it's around 4 million, but we think it's more. So, and we're not even calculating migrant workers from Nepal to India. So they're there's a huge concern. So what will be the fate of migrant workers now? So we're trying to work around that. But yeah, in a nutshell, that's what I've been trying to do, trying to make policies in Nepal a little bit pro-migrant workers friendly for the last couple of years.
No, that's amazing. And I think, you know, the sole fact that it's becoming a bigger issue and that is being talked about is already, you know, a good sign. And it's already a sign that it's serious issues and it's being taken into account. But if you could think about, the past kind of 6-7 years that you've been working on this issue, you know, can you pinpoint maybe, I don't know, a success story or something that, you know, that has worked well, or an improvement that you've witnessed, you know, either in the policy or in kind of public opinion or in a particular case, you know, where migrant workers actually got, I don't know, the right to return or whatever it was that they were advocating for. So I don't know if you have, you know, in your head some kind of examples of things that you've worked on that have actually worked.
Yeah, it's quite a coincidence, actually. I actually have more than one example, which can be seen as a success story. So my organization and I particularly have been working in 5 thematic issues. So I'll share 2 cases that I was personally involved in through my organization regarding rights of migrant workers. So one is it's very alarming issue that when we did our research, it's alarming data came up. So every 2 days, 3 migrant workers were dying in destination country. And then we looked into the cause. It was mostly cardiac arrest, cause of death, undisclosed. And then it was dubious cause. And then we looked into the process. And whenever someone aspired to become a migrant worker, in the process, they have to go through a medical checkup. And then the government approved medical centers should certify them as healthy before they pursue their job. So technically, government was certifying that Nepali migrant workers were healthy to go abroad and working. And when they were working, for the last 9 years, every 2 days, 3 migrant workers were dying. So it was concerning. And then we decided to look into what is the cause of the death. And in most of the cases, the cause of death was undisclosed. And for the ease of administrative purpose, in some cases, they said it's just cardiac arrest. And even causes as dehydration and traffic accidents were leading cause in death of migrant workers. So we thought we need to do something about it. So we developed a case and filed it in Supreme Court of Nepal, which had 8 demands. So we actually asked court to declare that the government needs to revise the curriculum that migrant workers are taught, the orientation training regarding orientation training, and then regarding the health risk, the notification to migrant workers, and then obligation of Nepal government to take all necessary measures at home so they can reduce the death rate abroad, such as like teaching them about health risk, teaching them about traffic rules, teaching them about the probable like health risk. And then there's other related issues as well. But in broad, it invoked obligation of a sending country to take measures in their country to reduce the death at destination country. So it was quite an experimental litigation in terms of due diligence obligation. But Supreme Court of Nepal was convinced that it's Nepal government's obligation to respect the right to life. So they have obligation, even though the workers are dying in destination country, they have obligation to make sure everything is done better at home country and every necessary measures are taken care of, and government do all that's necessary so that the at least the preventable deaths could, the numbers could be brought down. So it's one of the very significant judgment that recently came from Supreme Court of Nepal. So how it works is like you file a case, you litigate, and once the decision is given, it has to come in like full verdict, the full court, full judgment in written form. Only after that, the other process actually starts. So we got the full judgment around 6 months back, after 2 years of litigation process, but it's completed now. And now, based on that judgment, the government institution are taking necessary measures. Now it's more like guiding thing on what should be reformed in Nepal. So that's like one of the policy level.
That's amazing. That's really cool.
Yeah, and another very interesting case which got huge media attention, not only in Nepal but in Hong Kong and then like in a lot of different places. And it's the most widely talked about case recently is regarding the voting rights of migrant workers. And typically, like how it works in Nepal is like if you're not in country, you cannot vote. So what we decided is in our research, like we had like very solid data. There's like more than 30% of chunk of GDP is contributed by migrant workers in Nepal. So that's interesting, but they can't vote because they are not in country. So technically, government can decide through parliament based on the remittances that's sent by migrant workers, but migrant workers don't have a say when it comes to election on identifying like who will be the one leading the government. So without like it's not the way it should be. And then there's another like very interesting fact that most of the political leaders who are in position were not very concerned about migrant workers' plight. Like every time migrant workers' issue came up, they're not very serious, or they do not give it as much as attention that give to other issues. And then we thought of like, what if migrant workers could vote? And then like we did a little bit of our mathematics, and it came out like if everyone like outside Nepal, like particularly migrant workers, voted to a single political party in Nepal, that would be the biggest political party in Nepal, like in one election. So we thought like, why not like make migrant workers issue a bit politicized and talk about migrant workers' right to vote? That way you can also hold political parties accountable, because they'll be concerned now. It's not just migrant workers, it's also a prospective vote for them. So we thought like this can help build up accountability chain in terms of like my political parties and concerns of migrant workers. So we filed a litigation claiming that we had, like everyone should have voting right irrespective of whether or not they are in country. And particularly it should start with migrant workers, because they are the one taking care of economy through remittance. So we filed that case. It was quite interesting when we filed it, because like a lot of the lawyers were very skeptic. Even some of the lawyers in our team were skeptic of whether or not it would be successful, because like if it's successful, it will change the entire political dynamics of Nepal in years to come. So in that case, we got positive judgment in that one as well, where court pronounced that everyone has voting right. It should not be limited by the fact of where you're based, and it ordered government to take necessary measures to start framing laws and then like do research on what kind of election module would be helpful for Nepal. So maybe in years to come, when we'll have election, I'll get to vote even if I'm not in Nepal. So that's like one of the interesting cases I always share, where I was involved and our team was involved. So that's like another case.
Absolutely. And I think it's a really great example, you know, of how we can bridge the gaps between the legal side of human rights and the political side of human rights, right? So it's a great example. Thanks a lot for sharing this. I love success stories, you know, and I love kind of getting into details, you know, of how things work and what are the kind of, you know, ripple effects of a decision or of certain things. And one of the things that comes out of what you're saying, which I think is fascinating, is the importance of numbers, of research figures, of kind of capturing data about a particular issue so that you can push your agenda for change. So I think it's super powerful when you say 30% of the GDP is made up by remittances of migrant workers. I mean, this is, it's such an important visual and an important figure. So research is definitely key in a lot of these cases. So I think I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you feel about the human rights framework, you know, as a framework to progress these kind of agendas, you know, the agenda for rights. I mean, is the human rights language used in Nepal? Is it working? You know, are there any kind of bad press that goes with using the human rights language in Nepal? Or is that something that's kind of completely accepted and I don't know, appreciated? I mean, how are human rights as a tool useful for you and for the work that you do in Nepal?
I think it's a very interesting debate that you pointed on language of human rights and whether it has acceptance in Nepal. But before going into that, I'd like to go back and add a bit on what you said. Like particularly research and storytelling is like one of the most important part of human rights that I actually have Absolutely. Realized when working on it. Because like when we talk broadly, like, okay, migrant workers' rights are violated, and then like other things, it does not give the actual picture. So like humanizing it and putting face and stories to the broader narrative has always been part of our work. So it's more like you get personally touched by story rather than like a generic ideals of human rights. So I think one part of working in human rights is also that's very necessary when you're working in policy. Is like we'll have to make those drafting the policy realize what's the plight. It's more like they have to walk in the shoes, which technically is quite a thing. But I think like putting a human story, a face to a story of migrant workers or human rights abuse makes it more powerful in media and as well as in policy framing. And once it takes a form of a story, then media picks it up, then there's a broad momentum. That's what happened in Nepal. You know, if someone is interested and wants to look into like how migrant workers' concerns started in Nepal, we could pinpoint to a Guardian newspaper report, which did a story about migrant workers working in Qatar in stadiums being made for FIFA. And that went viral. And all of a sudden, from like very less known issue, a human rights issue, it became one of the most pertinent human rights concern in Nepal. So I think that's the power of storytelling. That's important. And yeah, coming back to like how the language of human rights is considered in Nepal, it does have two parts. So particularly in Nepal, there's clearly two different sections. Like we have used human rights as a tool for reform in a lot of different areas that's not globally talked about. So Nepal is one of the most progressive country in LGBTI issues. And the reform that we have now, the recognition we have now, is result of a case judgment that was given by Supreme Court of Nepal. And particularly lawyers have used human rights as a very significant tool that they have in inducing policy reforms and then restraining government's action. For example, when government was trying to like technically hijack transitional justice process, it was through court process, human rights lawyers halted the government attempts where they wanted a substandard transitional justice mechanism. So there's a wide array of use of human rights law in Nepal. Technically, because Nepal also have ratified like NESA human rights treaties, so there's scope without reservation, that is. So we have scope, and it's been like very widely used. That's one part of it. But now recently with this global trend of governments attempt to curb like civil society organization and human rights narrative, it has its impact on Nepal as well. So there's like environment where people are a bit skeptic about human rights as well. And one of the issues that we constantly face, that I constantly face while I'm teaching or while I'm doing my work, is like We talk about human rights as rhetoric. That's fine. Like, everyone agrees to that. But if you look into reality, the realities of human rights are not translated in realities of everyday people. So there's this bit of discontent with some because they don't see it translated in actuality. And in part of government, it seems that they're a bit bothered by some of the human rights standards. Like, they don't get it their way, so it's always there. So there's a bit of different sphere, I'd say. We do have this anti-human rights narrative building up gradually that is based on work of civil society organization where people are concerned about how civil society organization functions and a lot of different things, which is global now. But otherwise, Nepal can be seen as one of the very good examples where human rights has been used as a tool for legislative reforms, for policy reforms, and in restricting governments doing. Like, I'd close this with a very recent example. What government decided regarding this COVID situation was when people were trying to come back to Nepal from India, they decided to hold them in India border because of quarantine and other issues. But that did not go well with media, and people were concerned by the standard that was provided in quarantine. And then there's this question of whether everyone is entitled to right to return. So a week back, few lawyers filed a case in court, and court pronounced that everyone has right to return and government should make sure that everyone gets to their home properly, with taking necessary precautions so that they wouldn't contribute in spreading the virus. But the point is that we have a very vibrant judiciary, and lawyers are relying on using human rights through courts in broader changes. But there are a few alarming concerns as well on the other side.
No, absolutely. And I think it's fascinating how you're talking about how human rights are winning the popularity contest when you have kind of a joint alliance of actors working together. So, you know, lawyers and the media and probably some kind of grassroots campaigns, transnational, transborder groups of, you know, migrant workers' rights associations or things like this. So in that spirit, you know, of communities, I wanted to talk a little bit about, in your experience in Nepal, is there a strong community of human rights practitioners, and or do you feel like the topics are really kind of spread, you know, and so you have people working on environmental issues, people working on kind of social issues, and they don't really meet or they don't really join up? I mean, I'm kind of wondering, you know, how is the social rights community, social justice, social rights community in Nepal, how is it organized? How does it work? How well is the solidarity, you know, amongst kind of different actors and different thematic?
Particularly, we have very strong civil society organizations presence. But unfortunately, like for currently, like, this year and in recent year, there has been, the presence has been a bit weaker, considering like how strong our civil society was a decade back and the leadership it had when we were going through transition, where we overthrew our monarchy. And then at that point of time, our civil society organization was one of the key actors. Considering to what we had 5 years back, 10 years back, and when, like, I personally, SSIC, there's like this gap of leadership, and it does not have the same strength it had like a few years back. But even now, we have a very strong civil society organization. They have a network, so they're like essentially, for example, when we talk about migrant workers, like, there's network of civil society organization which brings together all civil society organization working in issues of migrant workers. For example, some work in rehabilitation of migrant workers, some work regarding women migrant workers, some work in life skill development. It's not necessary that it's predominantly like lawyers or professionals. That we have organizations that's led by those who were like migrant workers before, and it's same in all sectors. So that we have very vibrant community of civil society organization led by interest group as well, the professionals. So, and there's a network of them as well, and it comes together when it's necessary, and they're also working interdisciplinary in a lot of different aspects. For example, even when we develop case, it's not just lawyers sitting together and deciding what we want to litigate and what policies we need to change. We work with returning migrant workers, others working in different areas of migration, we work in different cycles of migration. We get in consultation with them, then we develop something, like go back to them and then discuss. So there's intersectionality is there. We're working there. We have a very strong civil society organization. But particularly in recent years, I think like I'd say that there's been lack of strong leadership between civil society organizations. The harmonization hasn't been that, say, considering to like how vibrant the community was a few years back.
And so do you feel like the teaching that you're doing, that you've been doing, you know, for the past kind of 6, 7 years since you got back, do you feel like you're teaching kind of the next generation of human rights leaders? I mean, that must be really gratifying, right? To be teaching undergrads all things related to human rights. Like, do you want to tell us a little bit more about the teaching parts of your professional life?
The teaching part, it's very interesting. It's something like I find very, as you said, it's my way of giving back, because when I studied in Nepal and then like I got this amazing opportunity and scholarship and like European Union paid for my studies and everything. So I thought like when I came back, I wanted to give back in one way or other. And then like I realized teaching is one of the proper way that I can contribute back to my society. So as soon as I came back, I got involved with law school. Then I started teaching in two different places. I used to teach graduate students as well. So it's my way of teaching new generation of lawyers that I learned in different parts of the world, because like it's not possible for everyone to have that opportunity to get to travel and then like be part of a different institution and learn all this. So I thought like that opportunity I got and the learning I derived from all those experience is something that's valued, and I can share that with young lawyers here. So I thought that way, and I got into teaching, and I also liked teaching very much, because it was very engaging, and then like you actually know about the difference and then like opinion of different students. So it's very interesting academically, and I think it's very interesting. And even like for instance, now I'm very busy with other work like that I have, but I keep on like taking the class. It's something like I'd never let go of, because like it's been a very fulfilling journey for me as well. It's just like I feel I contribute more as a human rights teacher than probably as a human rights lawyers, because like it just magnifies and multiplies like the way lawyers will think. So I think it's a very good opportunity and platform for me to make students think a little bit broader and then like help them or transfer the knowledge that I acquired to them. So I think it's very interesting. And I actually love teaching more than my job, to be very honest.
That sounds really cool. And you have really great, you know, concrete case and examples as well from your professional life that you can bring onto your teaching class, you know, which I think is amazing to draw this parallel, you know, between the two worlds, because I think the best teachers I ever had, you know, during my studies were people who had actually worked, you know, and who had kind of concrete examples and had been involved in like campaigning or, you know, court cases or whatever, you know, and could bring this practical knowledge onto the theoretical debates that were happening in the classroom. So I think that's super fun. So one question that I really like to ask people is, you know, if you were not a human rights lawyer or if you were not a human rights teacher, do you know what you would be doing? I mean, is there like another path for you that could have worked, that could have fulfilled you on an intellectual and professional level? Could you think of anything else?
It's a very interesting question to ponder on. But when I completed my undergraduate law in Nepal, I actually worked for a while as corporate lawyer. So I consulted like corporate entities. I was involved in litigation regarding to business houses, like companies law, and that wasn't very much my cup of tea. So then I was like, okay, I need to do something that I find more meaning to. I'm not sure, like it's not something that we can be certain of, but now I've realized like during my research and when I'm reading, developed a strange like interest towards this developing tendency of digitalization and cryptocurrency regime, and I've always been very good with numbers, and maybe sometime I think like I could have been involved in investment sector, maybe I could have been stock trader, because I'm really interested in how the market works and economics of it. So I do a bit of reading regarding economics, market, and the supply chain and other things. So probably I'd be involved in career relating to investment, which is very different from what I do now, but I think I could possibly see myself as someone like working in investment area firm or something like that, maybe.
No, absolutely. I mean, and somehow that is kind of my twisted way of asking, or at least, you know, making a point of maybe human rights don't always have to be, you know, a professional career. Like maybe sometimes human rights can also be just something you carry forward in whatever it is you're doing, you know, like in the way you behave, you know, in the way you kind of get involved in social activities after work, you know, in your spare time with your family, with your friends, with your kind of neighbors, community, and all of this. So, you know, I think you can be in the investment sector or in the financial sector and still be carrying forwards, you know, some beliefs and some values and make a change, you know? So I think that's quite cool. Tell me, what's coming up for you in your career? What are the kind of next stages for you? Do you have any idea of what you'll be doing maybe in like, you know, the medium term, 2 to 5 years, you know, like, do you have any big projects coming up, or is it just going to be a bit more of the same and just engaging with new issues and progressing the migrant workers agenda? I mean, what's coming up for you?
Particularly, like, in terms of like what I have planned in terms of my human rights work is, so I've been part of this ongoing human rights movement in Nepal, particularly regarding to the rights of migrant workers. So for a few years, like, I already have made my commitments in terms of the litigation that we were part of and the, like, other ongoing litigation that we have currently ongoing. So I think, like, I have a moral and professional obligation to see it through, that we got really amazing judgments to show. Now we have to make sure that they are properly implemented in reality. Otherwise, all the work that we've done so far would only be like academic work and would be limited to like studying and referencing. So I think like for next few years, I'd still be involved in migrant workers issue, but the focus would be to translate what we have attained so far in the actuality. Like for instance, like we got a very positive judgment on due diligence obligation, voting rights, legal aid of migrants, and there are like few others as well, but we have to see it being implemented. So I think like I'd be more than happy to see, get an opportunity to vote when I'm doing my PhD elsewhere. And so that's what I want to see. So I think like for next 5 years, I'd be working on the same sector, making sure that what we've done so far doesn't go down the drain, and make sure that there's like enough attempts and inputs from our side to keep it going and like reflect it in our country and society.
No, absolutely. And I cannot wait to have, you know, a second episode with you maybe in 5 years and see what you've been up to and how things have progressed and all the success stories that you can share with us. Honestly, I think we've covered so much already. Thank you so much for making the time. I don't want to make it longer because I want to keep it kind of, you know, short and sweet. And we've been able to cover, you know, quite a wide range of issues. And you've been really inspiring. Thank you so much for sharing this update, you know, with me, with us. And I don't know if you have any final words that you want to say before we cut off.
First of all, like, thank you. For trusting, as I said earlier, that I got this opportunity to tell you and reflect on what we've done so far. But I think like my final words is like what we're doing now, we should like magnify this, like human rights professionals, like human rights lawyers, human rights activists, and those working in human rights needs to communicate with each other in different levels so that they can be support system, they can be like best case examples, inspiration, and then, like, you know, it's more like human rights defenders telling story to each other so that you get support, inspiration, and then, like, you have the sense of belonging. So I think it's a good thing. Like, these are kind of conversation we need more. We started this conversation because we already knew each other, but I think conversations like this have a very significant impact on how human rights defenders would, like, work in days to come. So I think it's very good venture you've started. Wish you best of luck, and I look forward to hearing like stories from lots of different like human rights activists and those working in a nonprofit sector in different parts of the world, and learn from them, get inspired, and then like maybe be more effective in what I do at home. Well, thank you.
No, absolutely. That's exactly what this podcast is humbly trying to contribute to. Thank you so, so much for your time. And I hope I'll see you next time I'm in Nepal to hike some kind of mountains. And I wish you all the best as well with all the, you know, ongoing work that you do and what's coming up as well for you. And all the best for this kind of weird periods of times that we are experiencing with this, you know, coronavirus. I hope this just becomes an old story very soon and we can move forward in a better way. Thank you so much for talking to me, and I will speak to you soon.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye, Varun. Bye.
Bye.